Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. Original recipe Book Riot Podcast after several weeks of spicy chicken. You know, this is what everyone does now. Thanks to Sharifa and Jen for sitting in for both of us at various times. Really good stuff. I listened to you and Jen talk about Workman for a little while. I don't think we need to get into there. I thought it was, it's really interesting. And like you guys, I think said explicitly or hinted, it's not a surprise after the several dominoes fell and the Simon & Schuster getting acquired and then the HMH trade getting acquired. Like, what's left? It kind of is interesting to see where those dominoes fall. So I recommend if you haven't, go check those out there. I guess points of order before we get into the show. We're hiring agains because there's multiple positions. We'll link in the show notes. One is for a full stack front and back end web engineer. If you know what that means, you know what it means. And if you don't, it doesn't matter to you. But there's a link in the show notes there as well.
Step one of the screening process.
Yeah. Do you know what the job is? The second one maybe requires a little more explanation because this could be used a different way. It's an AdOps associate. And this is one where you would be helping get the ads on the show, traffic to clients, reporting to our clients, like helping us make the ads pieces of what we do better, and you know, making sure the trains run on time. That's a more junior position, and I think if you're a generally competent person at all, you should at least look at the job descriptions. There are some other things that may or may not, you know, make it seem like it is interesting for you to fulfill. But go check those out. We'd be excited to get as many good applications as we can.
Yeah, for just some details about them in case you're wondering if it applies to you. Both of these positions have the option to work out of our offices in either Portland, Oregon or Vancouver, British Columbia. And we also have work from home jurisdictions in Illinois, New York, North Carolina, Pennsylvania and Virginia. So if you are in one of those places or you know someone who is and might be interested in these, please check out the link in the show notes for the applications. Our salaries are generous. Our benefits are generous. We have a 401k, health insurance, 160 hours of annual PTO. Y'all have heard us talk about open book management on the show. So staff participate in gain sharing as well. It's a pretty sweet setup. So we hope that you will share it with folks or take a look at it yourself.
All right, so let's take our first sponsor break that if you were the AdOps associate, maybe you would be trafficking here in the future, and then we'll come back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of. And bonus points because it's Finnish. And when's the last time you read a Finnish dystopian science fiction novel? Right, okay. So in this one, humanity is destroying itself as the cities burn, which sounds kind of familiar. It is the time of the great affliction. In this terrible world, a new hope arises. The Happiness Program, which is the creation of a Finnish pharmaceutical genius, Dr. Laura Solomon. With happiness, pills, mind mapping, and microchips, Dr. Solomon intends to build a new world for the worthy few, which sounds like a perfect plan and nothing could go wrong, right? Right. So this is a raw but fun dystopian sci-fi adventure with an unusual premise describing what happens when technology rules humanity. Either you're chipped living inside the AR society or you're left outside to barely survive. Make sure to check out Unchipped by Taya DeVere. And thanks again to Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? Six award-winning, best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all six short stories in the Nevertell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laureth Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Housel Hall, Avi Pachoda, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all six short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Programming note, we're going to try something different this fall. As listeners of the show have been around for, 6 months at least or longer, know that from time to time we do extra episodes, especially in the high seasons for publishing in the fall and then in the spring into the early summer. Part of that is subsidized by our advertising. Part of it is because there's more to talk about and we have other ideas and stuff we want to do beyond the regular show like today. This time we're trying a little bit something different where it's not advertising supported. The idea with we're going to use our fall preview draft, use the same format we use the last couple of seasonal previews where Rebecca and I each draft 10 books and see who can win in a publication recommendation off. Now that I say that, it seems even less and less, even further and further divorced for something like scorability and rationality. But it's a fun show. It's our way of taking a look at the books coming ahead. As we said, it is a bumper crop. It's the Brood X of book releases.
Truly,
here
truly.
In the fall. My list of possible candidates for my 10 selections is up to 97 titles, Jeff, at this point. Let's just say I'm not going to have any problem finding candidates. I may have a problem winning, but I'm going to have a problem finding candidates. So what we're going to do with this show is it's going to be outside of our normal feed. We're using a platform called Gumroad where you can go and download the episode, and it's going to be pay what you will. So if you feel like you want to throw a few bucks at it so that we'll do more of these bonus ones, great. If you're not in a position where that makes sense for you, we still want you to be able to listen. And we're going to see how this model of doing extra bonus content works. Like, you listen to a lot of podcasts, you know a lot of them are going to a subscription model of some kind where you get a weekly or monthly or whatever bonus content of some kind for a recurring subscription. We understand why that makes sense for some shows, why it's great. We're kind of in a weird position where a lot of we have more advertising infrastructure than a lot of independent shows do. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what we do is advertising, but not everything we do makes sense to be supported by advertising. So we're looking for other ways to subsidize and fund and, run a company on the kinds of content we want to make. So that's going to come out. We're shooting to have it available for Labor Day weekend. So that's next weekend, I guess. Do we have a date? Do we decide what date for sure we're going to try to do?
We are shooting to release it on Friday, September 3rd. So barring a surprise, that's when it'll be available. And we will then maybe drop a note into this podcast feed about that with information about where you can go find it.
Yeah, that's what I was planning on doing. As soon as that is live, you'll see a little blurb that'll show up as an announcement in this feed with a description. I'll probably say the URL out loud and include a link that people can find it there. That's another thing we're trying to figure out, like how to let people know about this, another thing. So it's an experiment for us. We may or may not do it again, but it's one of our favorite episodes of the year. But if we're only going weekly, then it takes up a new show and blah, blah, blah. So we're looking forward to it. I have my draft order in mind. I think we haven't talked about this at all. We have a little bit of a problem that we might have we both might have the number one overall draft.
Are you talking about the Colson Whitehead problem?
I've never heard of him. Not familiar with his work.
Have you heard of debut?
He'll probably be available. He'll be available for you at number two. If you don't take him, I'm sure you can get him.
Yeah, I don't think so.
So anyway, I think what we're going to do, We're going to do our draft, and we'll be in reverse order, and blah blah blah. It's a wonderful fall. Like, I'm looking at my number 15, 16, 17 picks. I'm like, yeah, those would be like must reads for me in a given season.
Oh yeah, I've downloaded so many galleys of fall releases that I'm going to be reading fall 2021 into like mm-hmm. April of next year. If I really
true.
Get to all of them, it is a wild and just really embarrassment of riches situation. You know, we haven't decided how we're going to decide who goes first, because the first draft that we did, you made the list of candidates, so I got to go first. And then right. The second time around, I made the list of candidates, and you got to go first. I mean, I'm the reigning champion, so I kind of think I should get to go first, but of course that's...
Make it, take it? No, I think it's like if you're the bottom team in the NBA from last season, you get the number one draft pick.
Hello, and welcome to Motivated Reasoning.
Well...
On both parts.
I learned it from you! The other thing we could do is, you know, random number generator. I was thinking about the Whitehead, though. What if we took it off the board?
Ah, okay.
Is that interesting? Because after that, it's not as obvious to me. That one's pretty clear, but after that, I could go in a number of different
directions. I think that
makes
it more interesting. We could just assume that whatever our set of 10 is, both of us tack on Colson Whitehead as
we have
the bonus.
11 picks, and we both picked Colson. You get Colson, and I get Whitehead. Yeah. I don't know. We'll decide. We'll make that
I
a
like
game
that
time
idea,
decision
taking it on. Yeah.
A little bit. The RSTNLE kind of a
yeah.
This
that's where we are with him. I don't think I told you that I was going back to read Sag Harbor this summer, and I just did it last week while you were on vacation, and it is wild going back to old Colson Whitehead, and when you know what future Colson Whitehead holds.
I know. Yeah, the Sag Harbor is also very good. It's just so different.
It's great, but it's like, wow, it has no portent of like, this guy's going to write the Underground Railroad in 10 years. It's incredible.
So anyway, we're trying to figure that out. But yeah, there's a lot of names, you know. I also was looking for I think both of us were looking for different things we're working on at spring 2022, which got to say a little bit weaker. I mean, quite a bit weaker. Spring's generally weaker than fall, but I think there's quite a drop right now.
This fall is just bananas because it has some books that were supposed to come out last fall and that were delayed, or come out this spring and were delayed because of COVID, and publishers doing their best at guessing about when the pandemic would settle down in a way that would support more reading of like serious literary fiction. It'll be very interesting. I don't think we're continuing to see title delays like that, even though the pandemic does continue to shift and move. And reading habits, I think, are now firmly established as like people are reading more right now. That's what the trends have shown. At least books have done just fine. So there's no publishing reason to delay a big release, though attention for things is interesting. I would kind of hate to be an author coming out this fall in this class of competitors.
You are not. Debut authors, I think I would have chosen the pandemic rather than this. Or
it
like,
is
we're still in it, the heart of the pandemic. Wherever
we are. Spicy proposition to be, you know, like just off the top of my head, Colson Whitehead, Lauren Groff, Claire V. Watkins. So
there's a David Sedaris, there's a Susan Orlean. I mean, just on the nonfiction front, there's a million. So we could go on, we will go on and on at length there. So looking forward to that. I guess related, the same thing is happening in movies. I mean, as a blockbuster movie watcher and a movie watcher in general, I get this fall, or so between, well, September 3rd is Shang-Chi, the new Marvel movie, and Christmas, which is Eternals, or no, excuse me, there's Spider-Man, there's also an Eternals movie, there's also a Top Gun Maverick, and a James Bond movie. And those are just like five right there. I will see none of them in the theater because I'm doing this stuff, but, and this stuff meaning trying not to infect myself or those around me. But the same thing has happened in movies, is like, they've been waiting and waiting, it's like, finally, it's time to move forward, and we'll see what happens there. So again, a small movie is going to have this sort of the same things to contend with that a debut author or mid-list author is going to have to deal with right now. What's the best of luck to everybody? I hope everyone buys and reads a whole bunch of books. Speaking of the fall, I don't think I've ever seen a story like this. Now, maybe this happens more often, and it's just one of those where the book itself, the author herself, and the hype and timeline is such that we would notice it, right? There's sort of a Bermuda Triangle of attention here, but Viking Young Readers, which is part of Penguin Random House Young Readers, blah, blah, blah. Amanda Gorman's book for young people, book of poems for young people, is coming out this fall. Originally listed at 1999, has been that way. It's been on the docket since January, like soon after the inauguration. We were talking about this, right? Like the Hill We Climb was going to come out, but then her new book of new work is going to come out for kids, young people in the fall. And I don't know. I've never seen this. You can tell me, but let me do the top line for people. They wanted to change it from 1999 to $24.99, which for a book of poetry for kids is a lot of money. That's a lot of money for poetry writ large. And I'm not saying it's not worth it. I'm just saying it's out of scale from what you would see from a book of poetry. And I know this is going to surprise everyone, but a price hike right now didn't go over super great, Rebecca. People are like,
not
what the hell?
We've
done pre-orders. Bookstores and other retailers have made orders. What's going to do? I have to pay more for these things? What is going on? This was in Publisher's Lunch, which is an industry newsletter that people in the industry read and subscribe to, which I do as well. So I can't cite it. I don't actually know who wrote this, and I can't link to it either, but I did want to give them credit for breaking this. And they said that was yesterday. And in today's Publisher's Lunch, they said, moments after our email went out, Viking decided to try to like back up and try to figure out how some way to accommodate the book orders that have already been made. I took it as read they were going to honor the price of the book orders that made. So I thought this was just for a new order. So I'm even doubly surprised here. So I guess a couple questions for you, Rebecca. One, do you remember anything like this happening before?
No. Okay. If this has happened before, I don't think it's happened on a high enough profile title that we would have noticed. And I don't know why a publisher would try this on a low profile title.
Yes. Why? Yeah. There's nothing but pain there, where at least you get some pain in the prospect of a few shekels more.
I just went and Googled. I was thinking, like, okay, what are other hardcover kids poetry collections? And the only thing that is available to my mind is like Shel Silverstein. Right. So for comparison, the hardcover of Where the Sidewalk Ends, which is a pretty big book,
is
$19.99 list price. So they're talking about Amanda Gorman, which I believe is a smaller collection, at what, $24.99?
Mm-hmm.
That's real. I mean, I get the urge to capitalize on her popularity right now, but adding on to the price of a book that's already gone out for pre-order, that's pretty spicy. And I think it's a really... I'm interested in what independent booksellers have to say about this, because if you're Amazon and you've got people who pre-ordered it for $19.99, you can just list it at $19.99, even though the list price has gone up, and not be impacted by it. But, you know, indie bookstores often don't have those same kinds of pricing flexibility available to them for reasons that we talk about all the time. But like, this seems like you should have just noted that we wish we had charged more for this book, and then you charge more for it the next time around. Or like
next
a special
time you
edition.
Have the next time Halley's Comet comes around, get out your telescope, right?
I mean, that's that the it's Halley's thing. Comet when it's happening to you. You know, like, if you didn't realize on January 21st, Amanda Gorman is phenomenal and people are going to buy her books and we want to make money on that, so let's charge $24.99 for this thing, I kind of can't help you. But also, I think $19.99 is a perfectly reasonable price.
It does seem that way. I don't know that there's a generous reading here because it is a price hike, but is there any reason we can surmise that might be something about other than just making more money? Like, is it a demand problem by like raising, they're having paper issues or delivery or royalty? Like, is there anything else to consider other than they thought they could make $5 more a copy and they knew they were going to sell 500,000 of them?
It would be the first time that a printing demand issue had resulted in a publisher trying price to sell hike. Fewer copies of a thing by raising the price.
Or just get more for what you had because you knew the demand is going to be there, I guess.
I think if you wanted to go this route, you announce a new special edition that has some sort of extra special thing attached to it, and you make it possible for people who have pre-ordered the first edition to like cancel those pre-orders and pre-order the new one at the higher price, make both available and see. You can actually get some interesting data there. How many people are willing to pay $5 more for whatever the special features are in the Amanda Gorman special edition? But this, I think this one is a challenging one for generous reads, also because of the nature of what Amanda Gorman writes about and the nature of the content
that
that's like she's young and wonderful and very inspiring and people want to buy her book and we want to capitalize on that, but also like let's try to make extra. I'm having a really challenging time, more so than usual, finding a generous reading for let's make more money off of this.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where it would make sense for there to be more priced elasticity in books than currently exist. Just as an anecdote that I'm mad about for my own personal life, because this is a podcast, this is what you can do, is we're in the market for a new car. And the new car we want, because of chip shortages and whatever else, it's hard to get, and a lot of people want it. So they're charging 10 grand over the sticker price for the car if you want to buy it. I don't love that because I don't, and I'm not paying it. I'm going to wait and be one of these people that waits 6 years to buy a new car because you're a Scrooge or whatever. But on the other hand, at least the dealer has the latitude to charge more. And then when there's a lower demand period, they charge less. You know, everyone knows this about buying cars. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you get an older model or something less popular, whatever, you can get less. So we have a mental model of going into the dealer and negotiating, and the price can be, you know, some sort of Heisenberg uncertainty cloud that orbits the sticker price. With books, it only goes down. The only thing that happens is it gets discounted in Amazon or Walmart or whatever places. There is no, except in the aftermarket, I guess, the collector's market, eBay or something else like that, but not from regular professional brick and mortar stores. Is there the capacity to say, you know what? We're going to sell a billion Becomings no matter what. I'm going to put my little sticker over the $24.99 and I'm going to make it $28.99. And that's right. Something booksellers have asked for in the past, especially independent bookstores. So I think there's maybe not a generous reading, but a more interesting conversation to be had around price elasticity. Because if an independent bookstore, which is going to sell a lot of these, this is the kind of book people buy at independent bookstores. They buy at brick and mortar bookstores. Children's books do extremely well here, there. This has a lot of brand name recognition. If we had it in sort of our DNA of how books work to say, you know what, Powell's or McNally Jackson, we're going to talk about in a minute, they put their little sticker over it, says it's $25.99. Yep. God bless them, but yeah, this is not the way to do that.
Right. That's a shift in publishing that would open up a lot of space and competitive, like not even advantage, but just the ability for independent bookstores to compete more with Amazon, is if the list price were what we see in other industries, which is the manufacturer suggested retail.
Or not even printed on the box. I mean, that's the weirdest thing. We've talked about this
before. Or not even printed on the book. And then, then you could see, like, as the person who runs the business, you could see what the suggested price is and you could price it according to what your business is doing. You could use the laws of supply and demand. Yes. Like, this is a place where publishing is very different from other industries because consumers are not used to seeing the supply and demand rules in action and how things are priced. It's just the book is priced the way it's priced, and it only goes down, especially if demand is lower. Like, we've seen Amazon drop prices on new hardcovers when we can assume that they're not selling very well based on this was hyped and it has not appeared on any bestseller lists. And oh, look, also Amazon's selling the hardcover for $13.99, trying to unload them.
Yes.
Book buyers are not used to seeing that go the other way, especially in what you're talking about with cars. It's not like this fancy cookbook that costs a lot because it's expensive to produce. Like, that's what the pricing is based on. These books are expensive to produce, and so, like, cookbooks are more expensive than a hardcover novel is. But we're never told as consumers, because bookstores don't have the ability to do it inside the industry, hey, just more people want to read this and we have limited copies of it, so we're raising the price, which happens in all kinds of other places. And it would be wonderful to see publishing have an industry-wide conversation about responding to those economic pressures, creating some more pricing elasticity. But this is not the entry point, or it's at least not an elegant entry point for that kind of conversation. It's really, this is one of those announcements in publishing that makes me be like, I really want to read the entire transcript of the meetings where this decision was made.
It almost makes you think that there wasn't a meeting, that someone was entering in a spreadsheet somewhere, almost like this, or was it Circe, the Madeline Miller?
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, you know what, we could get away with 25. This is, and then someone didn't think about, that's my generous reading, is this was a screw up, not a considered move.
Well, then why not walk it back? If it's a screw up, you say that was an error.
I'm trying here.
You may know this, and
if you don't, I'm going to open up to the wider audience, because this is a good little bird question. I have a just the hardcover that happened to be on my desk, The Thousand Crimes of Ming Xu by Tom Lin, which I read this summer, really liked. Haven't had a chance to talk about it. But anyway, on the front flap, it's got, you know, my nice dust jacket, hardcover. The price, $28 US, $35 Canadian. It's on the upper right-hand corner of the front flap dust jacket. Mm-hmm. If I'm McNally Jackson or whatever, and I wanted to, say, get my little pricing gun sticker thing out and pop over that with a $32, am I legally allowed to? Is what do my contract with my supplier let me do that, or am I not allowed to do it? Forget about the practical, like, optics things, but like, would I don't even know who this book is published by. Let me take a look here. Would I think it's Viking, actually, weirdly. No, Little Brown. Would Little Brown come a knocking if they saw that and say, hey, Jeff, I don't know if you know this, but your distribution agreement with us doesn't allow you to charge over cover price?
I don't know 100%, but I'm within a like 95% confidence index that it's not allowed.
It's not allowed.
Okay. If it were allowed, bookstores would be doing it.
Would be doing it for books like the new Amanda Gorman, or like, what's the last?
Right, or
I guess
like,
it was the Obama
last
book that was we had real concern about having enough copies. Wasn't one? Or something?
Yeah, and last year at the holiday season, like in the thick of COVID winter, Salt, Fat, Acid,
yes,
Heat was trending on
couldn't
Netflix, and you
yes
couldn't find copies of it, and like, folks at like two indie bookstores had the last remaining copies of it in the United States. I remember seeing it on Instagram, and like, they absolutely would right have been like, you can have these for $100, and somebody would have paid it if they were allowed to do that. I'm pretty sure that it's contractually not acceptable, but if we have little birdies who can confirm, that would be great.
Anyway, so that one, I'm not sure how that's going to resolve itself, but seems like an own goal to me. I don't think the amount of money they would have made or going to make is certainly worth all the Sturm und Drang they've signed up for themselves.
Yeah, for sure.
Here.
I wonder how many copies they've pre-sold. How many have been pre-ordered? I would love to know that.
I don't know. What a good question would be, you know, over a 5-year window, will this sell more, or will The Hill We Climb sell more? You would think The Hill We Climb, but I would think The Hill We Climb, but just because it was the inauguration poem, it came out first. But it's hard to, or you shouldn't discount school library teachers stuff over the long haul. So, had we a BookScan account, the long desired, ne'er purchased BookScan account. Someday we're gonna have to find some rationale for that. That's, you know, more plausible than just I want
curiosity.
It. Yeah, right. Speaking of independent bookstores, I dropped this in today. Another Publisher's Lunch exclusive breaking there. I haven't seen another place I could link to. So shouts to PL this week, especially. McNally Jackson Books is getting its own imprint with Simon & Schuster. Basically, they're going to be repackaging books that have been out. They'll be paperbacks, but there's a David Foster Wallace backlist. There's some other names that I haven't heard of. They're going to Pete Mendelsohn, who has been a guest on Reading Lives when we had that show. Superstar designer, novelist, book acolyte is going to do a bunch of the cover designs. They're going to have new intros. And McNally Jackson is going to, I guess, curate them, put them out front. I thought this was fascinating and doesn't matter at the same time. And maybe, is that unfair?
No.
Are you different than me?
No, I was going to be a little bit more generous.
Yeah. Well, here's what's weird, is it will matter for these backlist titles that, if they're selling 15 copies a week right now, I'd be shocked.
Right.
I think McNally Jackson can sell more than 15 copies a week of these in their own special editions that they put out in front. It's got to be like the most valuable, or it has to do the most revenue of any independent bookstore in America chain, right? Maybe outside of Powell's. But like, when you think of an independent bookstore, it's New York, the publishing industry. These are super affluent clientels. They buy a lot of books. Like, this is kind of where you would do it, right? If you were going to do
something
like
this.
Yeah,
I think that's what I was going to say, is if any independent bookstore can make a go of something like this that will heavily rely on hand selling for its success,
right,
it's McNally Jackson. They have the right customer base for these, like, let's just call it obscure and out of and out of print, mm-hmm. previously out of print titles. And they're like right in the heart of literary hipsterdom, where people are interested in that kind of stuff. Like in hearing their independent bookstore say, here is an older book that we are bringing back to life and let me hand sell it to you. So if anybody can make a go of this, but like, are you going to see like a Barnes & Noble ordering in a bunch of copies of the McNally Jackson editions and then turning them into big sellers? Probably not. So I agree, in the big picture, it probably doesn't matter much. But I think for McNally Jackson, this is an interesting move. It could have an impact on, like, you know, what their best-selling titles are in store. And certainly on, as you were saying, the authors of these books who, you know, have very likely not been selling much at all in a given week. And now they're going to have, you know, they have a store with an active interest in selling them. What kind of marketing budget is going to happen here? I have tons of questions about if there is one. Also, like, I'm not entirely sure if this is a McNally Jackson imprint at Simon & Schuster, or this is a thing that McNally Jackson Books has created and Simon & Schuster is just distributing it. Because there's an important difference there. Like, is Simon & Schuster invested in the infrastructure of this? Do they have editors working on it? Are they putting marketing budget toward it? Are these Simon & Schuster books that McNally Jackson curates? Or is this a McNally Jackson project and Simon & Schuster just ships the books?
Can I guess? Would you like to hear my guess of what the
business arrangement
is?
I would like to hear your book, yes.
And some of this is, we've explored something not dissimilar from this in the past. And I'll keep the names of imprints and everything else out of it. But my guess is that it operates something like this. Either McNally Jackson had this idea, or someone at Simon & Schuster who's a McNally Jackson fan had an idea of, I'm assuming they're picking from Simon & Schuster-owned titles already. So you already have the copyright to all this stuff. You don't have to go out and acquire anything. You don't have to develop new royalty statements, anything else like that. All that's really happening here is we're getting a new cover and maybe a new intro, and we're going to print 1,000 of them, and McNally Jackson's going to try to sell them through.
Yeah.
That's my guess of what the minimum viable project is here.
I think that's a good guess, and it'll be interesting to see if this still exists in the fall of 2022. Yeah,
that's right. This is a very tough game. Now, again, you're taking a lot of the overhead out because you've done all the upfront costs. Maybe these books have even earned out so that you don't have to, you know, there's something else going on here. I'd like to know what the business arrangement is. Presumably, McNally Jackson is getting a piece of the price in addition to what they'd get from just selling it themselves, right? There's got to be some additional incentive. Now, is Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn going to carry these?
Oh, that's a great
question. See why not, but if they were so great sellers, they'd be selling them already. Does having like the McNally Jackson, I think that's what your marketing question is. Is the idea here is like the front of the independent bookstore has out of scale impact in the ability and the hand sell and all that means. I'm using that for the sort of the broad value of what an independent bookstore provides, or really any bookstore with sellers worth their salt. McNally Jackson's like, why shouldn't we get more? Because we provide more value here. And here's a way of codifying in that way. Is it that much more than co-op, I would wonder, the deal? Because if not, why not just have Simon & Schuster say, hey, what books do you think would sell particularly well and give you a co-op deal? Why brand it this way? Again, my priors for all this stuff is no imprint matters.
Yeah.
Outside of a very specific genre where it can matter. Bourdain doesn't matter. Sarah Jessica, what's going on with Phoebe Robinson's thing that we talked about, or Roxane Gaines? Like, no one knows. We make these announcements and then nothing happens. So that's my prior, is that nothing will happen. Maybe they'll be like Barnes & Noble Discovery Picks, where it's a nice way of branding something, gives you an excuse to put something on the front, and you get a few more dollars, make people feel special. I don't know. But it's hard to see how, it's certainly not scalable to every independent bookstore of any size in this country. I mean, there's not that many of them, like, I guess, Book People in Austin or Powell's or The Strand. But even Barnes & Noble doesn't do this, which should tell you something. Now, maybe they've missed it. But, like, you would think they would be the ones to be like, especially 10 years ago, let's do our own imprint. Why not? They missed that completely, and maybe they were right, maybe they were wrong. But it does make you wonder that this is a really interesting idea writ large.
It does. And, you know, a Barnes & Noble imprint that worked like a regular imprint does, where you're like dealing with agents and sourcing yes. brand new books that have never been published. Barnes & Noble has a big enough profile that they, I think, feasibly could launch the mm-hmm. career of a new author. What Simon & Schuster had planned to do with these titles before McNally-Jackson had conversations with them, my assumption is Simon & Schuster had no intention to
That's
ever
right. There was, they were mothballed, right?
Yeah. Republish these. It wasn't like, hey, we've got these great titles and we want to bring them back and put some money behind them and let's go find McNally-Jackson. Like, I think I understand why McNally-Jackson was interested in doing something like this. And they even say in this piece that McNally-Jackson Editions was conceived at the height of the pandemic, when libraries in the world had shut their doors and a scarce paperback could command hundreds or even thousands of dollars. And so it makes sense that they started thinking about, like, well, what are some other books that are hard to find that we love and that we could sell? And going to Simon & Schuster with something like this is interesting. But, like, also, McNally-Jackson, like, you like these books, but the general reading public has stopped paying attention to them. So
yeah,
I think it's an interesting proposition. Like, I think it does rely on the power of the hand sell, which is a huge asset for indie bookstores. But why are they so confident about these particular titles that they can make them relevant and exciting again?
I got caught on that clause of when a paperback could sell for hundreds or even, what are we talking about? What's the antecedent for that? Do you know? What there paperback was, is McNally-Jackson could get $100,000 for?
It was, and I don't know that it was even McNally-Jackson, because they're not allowed. It was used copies. Like,
well, that's,
I
yeah,
saw,
right.
I think it was the Bridgertons. The only example that I saw.
Oh, no way. Really?
The only example I saw. So this is a good one for little birdies, too. Email us, podcast@bookriot.com if you remember. But I do remember that when the Bridgerton show was dropping on Netflix in the middle of, like, I think it was pandemic summer last year, folks were looking for old copies of some of the Bridgerton novels, and some of the used editions were selling on eBay for a lot of money. So much so that, I can't remember the author's name now. But
Julia
that the
Quinn.
Yes, the Julia Quinn came out on the internet being like, please don't buy these used copies for thousands of dollars. This
that's
is
what,
ridiculous.
That's what your Kindle is for.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess you're a collector.
But that's the only the only one that I can think of. Like, books, yeah. Shipping was hard last year at the height of the pandemic, but, like, popular titles that had been printed in the, like, thousands and thousands didn't actually become hard to get. It was books that were old or rare.
Like the collectibles market always has
right.
What would be different about this? And how does this address that? Yeah, I was like, there was some missing piece of the argument.
Yeah, and, like,
that I was...
buying habits early in the pandemic were so strange, and people were, like, panic shopping, and then we're also looking for, like, any taste of novelty because you've been stuck in your house. So, like, why not spend $100 on this old book on eBay? But I'm really interested in the sort of the full flow of reasoning into creating this project. And I wish that this were, like, a reported piece on, like, Vulture about here's what they did and why, rather than just these little snippets. This is not nearly enough information for me, Jeff.
You want the royalty statements. You like the copies of the advance. Do they
me
get
through
what
your
what
whole...
piece of the audiobook pie do they get all the way around?
Walk me through your whole decision making process. Yeah.
It is. I've never heard of it before, and I think in a lot of ways it makes more sense than thinking that Sarah Jessica Parker's whatever juice she brings to an imprint that's going to have one book every 2 years is going to matter. Even. Well, I guess Reith's is the exception that proves the rule, possibly. But, like, Oprah doesn't move the unit she used to, and we're going to get to this in a minute. There's another pick here. But, like, it's hard for someone who's au courant to stay courant for long enough to make an imprint worth it. I think publishing is a business of hits, and there's a lot of things that come out, and most of them lose monies, and the ones that don't really don't. And this seems to me to be betting on things that haven't earned anything of late. And there's something else going on here. Sometimes these things are as simple as someone wants to try it. We know this. We do this ourselves.
We do it all the time. Yeah.
So that would actually make a lot more sense to me than, like, we think this is an awesome business idea. Someone's like, this seems cool and we want to do it. And I have a friend there and all of everything else.
That... You saying it that way makes me just wish that we could have honest press releases. Like, I would have... I would have so much respect for an announcement of a project like this where they were like, we thought this would be interesting. Simon and Schuster was game. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. It's like on book blurbs, they should have some like disclosure of what the relationship is of the blurber to the person.
Yeah.
This is my cousin. And right. I need to say something nice about my cousin's book, so here we go.
Right. Similar or if it, you know, if there had to be an asterisk next to every blurb that was like, we have the same agent and we're doing each other favors.
That's right. It's my MFA teacher.
Right, right.
There's a lot of those. Same, that's probably going to be the most common one.
That one,
we
or we had
Iowa
the same
writers workshop together.
That, or we had the same mentor in our MFA programs, or we attended the like same bread loaf conference, or whatever. If you removed the economy of favors from the blurbing industry, you would have, my guess is like 85% fewer blurbs.
Yeah. Speaking of, there's a new Gary Esht Angart coming out this fall. The blurb, appropriately. Okay.
Oh,
I guess we get to the new Oprah pick. Her name, oh, it's Jeffers. What's her first name?
Honoré.
New book, which I've been looking forward to, The Love Letters of W.B. Du Bois, which sounds like a really cool book. Maybe you can read the description. I don't have it in front of me because I was trying to look for the announcement because I remember this getting a big advance and I thought I had it captured.
Oh, I don't remember that, but that's great. So it is The Love Songs of W.B. Du Bois and coming out from HarperCollins, multi-generational saga which spans the entire breadth of African American history, has received stunning pre-publication reviews for its scope and ambition. The novel's primary protagonist, Ailey Pearl Garfield, provides the lens through which we see a woman grappling with both the desire to break free from her family to establish her own identity and to probe secrets that have been kept too long in the dark. I am sold at multi-generational family saga, which spans the entire breadth of African American history. And a poet writing fiction is almost always an interesting exercise.
Got a couple of thoughts about this particular, but also that bridge out. But I want to take a quick sponsor break first because we're getting towards the middle of the show.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by Katie Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Louise can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric, and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by Katie Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Mobius, part of Hachette Book Group. I have for you a swashbuckling fantasy that is full of demons, possible gods, ghosts, and an ornery mule. So, S.F.R. Boros is one of the legendary sword-fighting magistrates known as the Great Coats and the king's personal investigator of the supernatural, and he is no stranger to tales of ghosts and demons. So, when the fractious monks of the abbey, rumored to be the birthplace of the gods, begin warring over claims of a new pantheon arising, the frantic abbot summons him to settle the dispute. Armed only with his famed investigative talents, his faltering skill with a blade, and imperious, his ornery mule. In the words of Donkey from Shrek, though, he's a noble steed, okay? Armed with all those things, Estevar must root out the source of the madness lurking inside the once sacred walls of Isola Sombra before its chaos spreads to the country he's sworn to protect. Pick up Crucible of Chaos by Sebastian de Castile for all of the wonderful things I just described to you. I mean, it sounds like a good time. And thanks again to Mobius, part of Hachette Book Group, for sponsoring this episode.
Excited to see this. This was on my list too. It's out now, right? It's out? You can go buy this, or is it coming soon?
Oh, Uber doesn't announce it until you can buy them.
Okay, smart.
Yeah.
And in fact, moved up the Nickel Boys, right? Was it the Nickel Boys got moved up for
say? Yes, it was the Nickel Boys.
It's Oprah's calendar, and publishing just waits with baited money to see. Exciting book. A little long for me to get super excited, but I'm sure it's pretty interesting too. But what made me think about this, did she pick The Sweetness of Water by Nathan Harris? Was that her pick
as
well this summer?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which I read. I really liked that one as well.
Oh, good. I hadn't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, yeah. It's really cool. With The Whitehead coming out, here's my meta observation. And I hadn't thought about this because I think the waters have risen around us. I'm not sure, and it should be this way for a lot of different reasons. Not a surprise, but it just struck me as this is the greatest time for Black literature there's ever been. It's not even close. I mean, we talk about the Harlem Renaissance, you talk about the Black Arts Movement and the 70s and everything else like this, but it's not close. I mean, you look at the depth chart, and we've got debut novelists coming out with really interesting... This book, The Sweetness of Water, and then what I've got on my long list, I'm going to spoil it here, so don't use it against me for the fall.
Your list of 95 contenders.
Yeah, yeah. My Monticello, which is a book of short stories that I'm really looking forward to. And we're across... It's not... Just is the wrong word, but sometimes historically, the prominence of Black literature have been in sort of the high literature moment, yes, or mid-list or literary fiction, you know, going back to the Renaissance, you know, really started, or even Phyllis Wheatley before, of like, you know, drawing room poetry, so to speak. But we've got Jasmine Guillory in romance, and we've got S.A. Crosby and Attica Locke in mystery thriller. We've got M.K. Jemisin in science fiction and fantasy. We've got MacArthur genius winners, Nobel Prize winners some days in the form of Whitehead. We've got the, you know, sort of the next generation in the Jesmyn Wards, in the Yaa Jessies. We've got all these debut novelists. We've got the Brandon Taylors. We've got essayists. We've got Tracy K. Smith and Kevin Young in poetry. It's incredible. I mean, you look at the depth chart of the Harlem Renaissance, which I know fairly well, like, I get 8 or 9 names, and I've got 30 more to give you right now of people do interesting work. And I think this is one of those situations that happens. Things come together. It takes some time, but it's an exciting time in Black literature that I can ever remember having studied. And I've done some of this. I'm not the world's foremost expert in this, for sure. But I put my bona fides on this up against most any general readers about understanding this. And it's remarkable. I could do 2 whole shelves of books that I thought were great from the last couple of years by Black authors. And that's not that they weren't capable of writing. It's because people are interested in publishing them. They have different kinds of marketing budgets. They different kind of recognition, a different kind of reader. So in a way, it's much more of a groundswell than things. There's so many little rivulets flowing into this river that I almost didn't realize we were in the Mississippi now and not just on some tributary of it.
I think that's a great point that we've gotten finally into a virtuous and self-fulfilling cycle, right, with the publishing of great books by Black writers, that publishing finally started, you know, publishing them a little bit more, marketing them to a general audience and not just to Black audiences, and seeing some success, seeing them get picked up by Oprah and Reese Witherspoon, right, seeing readers really fall for books, or like for, you know, fans of Jasmyn Guillory, that there is no fan better to have than a romance fan. And that reinforces publishing to like, oh, let's keep doing this. You know, I think Black writers are still really underrepresented in publishing, but you are, and both of these things can be true at the same time. The Black writers are remain underrepresented, and this is the best situation we have ever had yet in publishing for Black writers, that there's much more work to do. But I'm heartened, and I think we've had some conversations offline that, like, one of the ways that you know progress is happening like this is when a group that's been underrepresented starts to reach a place where, like, mediocrity is a thing that they're allowed to do publicly.
Some big advanced book kind of sucks, and it's like, okay, we did this.
Plenty white guys write books that are mediocre, and they had $1 million advances for them, and they didn't sell, and those people continue to have careers of some kind of stature, and that's one of the benchmarks. And I'm not going to name names, but we are entering a space where some of the big deals that have gone to Black writers and writers of other marginalized backgrounds come out, the book is fine, and like that's great that they're fine, that they don't all have to be knock it out of the park successes for publishing to continue to see the value and the import of not just continuing to publish these kinds of writers, but publishing even more of them in the future. And I do think that we're in a space where that sort of growth is happening. It's been enough years now since We Need Diverse Books launched that mm-hmm. some of the titles that were acquired in those initial moments after that movement began have started to come out and have been successful. This is a really, I think, very exciting time.
And, you know, just to compare it with the era I know best is that we've been following some people in the breadth of this podcast who's had longer careers than Wallace Thurman did, or even someone like Zora Neale Hurston, who famously was forgotten in Alice Walker to get to her grave with a weed whacker, essentially. I'm exaggerating there a little bit, but not too much. Whereby, you know, 1929, by the Depression, people were going elsewhere and it kind of moved to Chicago and Ellison and Richard Wright picked it up, but it was contingent on a historical moment in a way that this feels like it has much more pillars of the earth kind of support.
Yes.
Because like you say, a book can come and go that got a big advance. Yeah, Jesse can have a second book that's good, but not as transcendent as Homegoing, but she's going to get another big advance and people are going to read her. Britt Bennett writes The Vanishing Half, and it's a hit, even though The Mother's wasn't as big of a hit, but her second book sold more than the first, which is very unusual in this kind of movie. If it was more of a trend, I think we're out of the idea this is some sort of trend, this is in danger, this is there's no center, which I think is interesting. Mm-hmm. Like you could say about the Black Arts Movement or Harlem Renaissance, it's so distributed that it feels more built in, so it feels safer, it feels more secure. Mm-hmm. It feels more like this is, I guess, climate change in a positive way, as much as that's loaded, but there are things happening that are so exciting, and I guess I've not even noticed to be excited about. So it really struck me this morning. I saw this in there and I was like, God, there's another amazing sounding, interesting book. And it's just one of another. And I forgot it had come out. If this was 6 years ago, I would have never forgotten this book was coming out in a million years. Also, it's Du Bois. It is. I know. Don't email me. Don't mispronounce it to your professor. It's Du Bois. I know you want to say Dubois. It's not that. Trust 22-year-old Jeff who thought he knew his shit and screwed up in front of people that really had an influence over his life and got really embarrassed. So there you go.
Who among us has not had a moment like that?
And you're not wrong. It should be that, whatever, or should. If you think you're fancy, that's what it looks like. That's not what it is. There you go. Free one for those of you out there.
That just went in an unexpected direction, and I am here for it.
Because you know that 22-year-old Jeff going to grad school in New York wearing his pleated khakis thought he knew what it was.
Dubois.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy, oh boy. I'm getting the shakes just thinking about that.
We're sending real compassion to 22-year-old Jeff in his pleated khakis.
He was fine. Don't worry. He's going to do okay.
Can we talk a little bit more about authors with like surprising audience attention?
Yeah. 1 second. Last sponsor break before we do that. That's a great hook.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social-climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must-read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee. So I am super excited about this one. It has what sounds like a really interesting, unique magic system. It is a medical magic system, and the world is based in a Vietnam-inspired fantasy world. And it follows Nika, who is what you call a blood carver. And blood carvers are these beings who can alter human biology with a single touch. Now, to people like Thumas, she is a monster who can be traded for gold. So one day she gets caught and she's forced to heal the last witness to a high profile murder. And all signs in her investigation point to an alluring physician's aide, Cochin. But then she discovers Cochin is not who he says he is. And she's suddenly faced with a greater evil lurking in the city. Now, her only chance to survive lies in a choice. She can become the monster the city fears or risk the future of her kind. Amazing. I'm so excited. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee for sponsoring this episode.
Okay. Surprising audience attention.
50 bookshops in the UK are opening early for the publication of Sally Rooney's new novel, Beautiful World, Where Are You? 30 branches of Waterstones, which now we know how to pronounce correctly, and 20
It's Waterstois.
Indies.
Waterstois is how you would say that.
Aquastones.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's Friday. August.
Friday
what
afternoon
else do we
in
think
August.
Is, yeah. Yeah, August is the summer of the soul, truly. So anyway, 30 branches of Waterstones and 20 independent bookstores were going to open their doors to give customers the first chance to buy a copy and receive an exclusive goodie bag and merchandise. Okay, I know people like Sally Rooney. Do they like her enough to go to the bookstore like at 9 a.m. on release day and press their little noses against the glass and... Please, sir, may I have my goodie bag?
Yeah, could I get some awkward 20-year-old ennui sex, I guess, is what people are looking for. I can't remember. The only adult author I know that this happens for is Murakami in Japan. We have midnight release parties. I can't think of the last time there was an Anglophone writer.
No.
I don't think we did. We open early for like the next book after the Da Vinci? I'm trying to even think of what it would have been.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I go to my local bookstore on release day of Dan Brown books because I like the ritual. Of, yes. But I know that I'm pretty alone in that because there's not a line of people there at 9 a.m. with me to get the new one.
Well, they were all there at midnight.
Yeah, the only things that I've seen stores stay open late for are almost always kids and YA hits. Yeah. You know, you got it for... the Twilight series and Hunger Games when those books were coming out for the last couple Harry Potters. Maybe for a 50 Shades of Grey, but I don't remember that.
That's a good one. That's a good one because I'm not discounting Twilight because that was important, but in terms of it doesn't qualify as an adult title.
Right.
The last like, 50 Shades Freed, was that the last one?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And those are events, like capital E event in publishing is a release of a book like that. And it's very possible that my understanding of the scale of fandom for Sally Rooney is wrong. And that's the question I'm asking. Like, do I just not know how excited people really are for new Sally Rooney novel day? And are they going to be lining up outside these 50 shops to get their copy early? Like, because I do not understand Sally Rooney to be on the same scale of excitement for a new title as like the final E.L. James book or a Murakami release.
I mean, we got to think that Waterstones knows what they're doing. I mean, you're sort of positing, do they know what they're doing? If they don't, maybe it's going to be midnight and no one's going to show up for this.
Like, well, and I guess there's implicit in this is like they're going to have the goodie bags on hand,
right?
So it's not like you have to come at the early opening to get the thing. I'm sure they'll sell some Sally Rooney copies throughout the day or the week or like put some signage up of buy your new Sally Rooney while we still have these goodie bags for you. So I'm just curious. Like, I know that there's Sally Rooney interest and excitement and fandom, but... I was just surprised to see this headline.
I was too.
Like, really? Is she that big? And maybe she's bigger in the UK. I need it to make sense. I need also to believe that Waterstones like knows what they're doing. The publisher has to agree to this kind of thing to let bookshops open early. So like, you know, I guess there's no harm in it really. Like, of course, go ahead. Try to sell some extra ones early.
Well, you think if no one shows up, they're like, it doesn't matter. Because it's a Viking title too, or Knopf.
Yeah, like there's kind of no downside to trying it. But I'm curious about what the assumed upside
Well,
is.
At the very least... They think it might be, which I think is enough of a surprise to us. Whether or not anyone shows up, that Waterstones thinks that this could happen, because I wouldn't have thought that. I don't know Rooney would have been on my top 20 to say, okay, you get 20 Anglophone writers. What's your draft order for who could support a midnight release party. Again, I'm not the right... I like Sally Rooney fine. I read both Normal People and Conversations with Friends. Is that the first one? It's one of the generic titles I can't remember. Anyway, I like it fine. I'm a little... I would have liked a lot... 22-year-old pleated khaki Jeff, which I'm way more into that in a lot of different ways without telling tales out of school. But so I think she's great, and I understand the deal, even if it's not for me. I guess I'm just surprised. I'm really just surprised to see that that would be a thing.
Yeah, I'm surprised too. And if you had asked me, like, top 20 Anglophone writers that you would try something like this on, if we had knocked out, you know, the James Pattersons and the Nora Robertses, like the big marketing ones.
I think they publish too much, though. It's not special
enough.
I
think they do too. But, like, we're not getting press releases about a bunch of bookstores opening early for the day that Harlem Shuffle comes out. And if there is, if you're for a literary fiction reader, like, there's not much that's more exciting in this year than a new Colson Whitehead. Like, and I have to think that that's more exciting in terms of sales potential than a new Sally Rooney is. So maybe this is just another example of where the press release should have said, we think this might be interesting, let's try it.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, not for nothing, if you're a 20-something-year-old literary reader, you've got time to go at midnight. Whereas the Whitehead reader is probably older on the whole, and we know we're not just as excited. We can get the book. I'm serious. I got things to do. I got to be in bed by 9:30.
I'm not going anywhere that starts after 8 p.m. No.
And you and I don't care that much about, like, the special sauce, like, tote bag thing that comes with it either. Like, if it was actually scarce.
The only thing that would get me to a bookstore at midnight is there's a secret Toni Morrison novel that we just found. It's actually a new book. It's not the Harper Lee treatment. And you, like, have to come at midnight
if
you want to get it.
You're such a liar. You wouldn't go to a midnight. You would not go.
No. I said only if you could only get it if you went to at midnight. Yeah, otherwise, I'm waiting till 9 a.m. the next day.
Yeah, I was going to say that. There's no book release that I'm going, well, wait, is that true? Is that true? Let me think about this. Because I think if it's something my kids were into, and it would be like a fun thing to do,
that's a totally different category.
Yes, I'm just saying that, but I'm going up one level. I'm going from your lying to my interesting observations about things.
Oh, right. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, that's what we're doing right now. I don't know.
You're
man.
Interesting and I'm a liar. There's the show title.
You're an interesting liar. I am a boring truth teller. Not appreciated in my own mundacity. Yeah, even the series my kids are into, it's like the 9th Diary of a Wimpy Kid. There's not much there. It
Dog
has to
Man
be a series. It has to be
712.
It has to be what's going on next in the series. Like, the Harry Potter is the one. Like, the new Karina Jan Glaser's new installment, the Vanderbeekers of 141st Street series, is the book my family is most looking forward to in the fall. But they're pretty much standalones. Like, they're in the same world. The kids go older, but there's not, like, you know, one of the characters is hanging off a fire escape, or there's a dark wizard that got a new whatever that's threatening the
There's
something.
Not a cliffhanger moment.
Yeah. So it doesn't really matter in that way. The last one that was a big deal here was Cursed Child in America. I can't think of another one that really... I wonder if some circles, if there were more dedicated romance stores, I wonder on the genre level. Now, when George R. R. Martin comes out with... the
when
new
is
Game
a
of
vote
Thrones
of
book.
There will be
parties for that. That's the only one.
Totally.
That would, and maybe the Rothfuss when that one comes out.
and like maybe the Ripped Bodice does parties for Sarah McLean or some of those like highly anticipated romance titles. I think this the excitement lives in genre and kids, like where fandom lives. Typically,
that's right.
Literary fiction fandom is a different, smaller beast. It's a lesser animal.
It's a lesser animal. It's like a hamster.
But if you know Colson Whitehead, please don't ever tell him that we equated literary fiction to a hamster.
Everybody has one, but you're not putting your hamster on Instagram. There's no National Hamster Day.
I'm feeling some need to distance myself from this statement that you're making about hamsters.
It's all right. Well, we'll see. We'll see how this hamster talk goes. It'll be the guinea pig for our pet discussion.
Oh, all the rodents!
All right, I think that's our show.
I think we better stop now.
Email us at podcast@bookriot.com for all your non-disposable pet talk. Especially want to know about What were the paperbacks that were going for $1,000 that McNally Jackson wanted to sell if they could, or if you were seeing special demand? Also, I know we have booksellers out there. What do you guys think of this McNally Jackson thing? Is there, what part of the business model am I not, we not, seeing here? And we'll talk to you, well, I guess the next time we'll hear from me is a little, hey, you can go get the, draft episode from there. So looking forward to that. Rebecca, thank you for your truth-telling, as always.
Have a good one.